Welcome to Insights and Indicators. I'm Jason Thomas, Carlyle's Head of Global Research and Investment Strategy. And in this podcast, I share our observations and opinions on the economic landscape, as well as insights from research being conducted by our team here at Carlyle. Today, I have the pleasure of being joined by Shane Clifford, Carlyle's Head of Global Wealth, and we'll discuss how alternative investing is becoming more popular with individual investors and what that landscape may look like in the future. This episode was recorded on August 5th, 2024, and the discussion reflects composite portfolio data and analysis of recent government reports that are accurate as of that date. Before turning it over to Shane for some questions, I do want to talk for a moment about the recent market volatility. The first point I would make here is that a market that was set up for 6 to 7 rate cuts without any deceleration in growth, of course, as was the case entering the year, was never likely to deal well with the actual data necessary to yield rate cuts. As we've emphasized in Carlyle Compass, published June 11th, and then also on July 9th, rate cuts tend to arrive in the context of a growth scare. You know, generally, when cuts occur, it's when some portion of the market is warning of recession risk. And these cuts rarely arrive or rarely serve as a happy occasion that some were anticipating, in this case, really to celebrate the economy's vanquishment of inflation. So, you know, I think people thought this time would be different, but as it turns out, you know, it's very much the same as previous episodes where rate cuts, and we're of course on the precipice of at least one, likely more in the fall, are coming at the same time that people are increasingly worried about recession. Now, as it relates to the real data and what we've seen in the portfolio, I would say over the past 2 months, we have reported some deceleration. Our portfolio composite, which we take incoming data, algorithmically weight it to replicate US GDP, showed slowing real growth from 2.4% in May of 2024 to about 1.8% in July, with average price increases across the portfolio down from 2.8% to about 2.5%. So really what this means is corporate revenue growth, and again, this is not our portfolio, but economy-wide estimates derived from our portfolio, down from about an annual rate of 5.2% in the spring to about 4.3% today. At the same time, we did see through various employment services in the portfolio, some weakening labor demand, particularly a 14% drop in hiring. This is open but unfilled positions in leisure and hospitality, and also continued weakness in tech sector employment, and that's particularly computer programmers. So again, as we've noted the past 2 months, rate cuts were coming. The case for rate cuts had been made, it seemed in the data, and this seemed most likely to start in September. But I would say that, you know, these data really aren't that bad. You know, that there's nothing alarming or particularly frightening about them. And I think in a different market environment, different from the one that described with the expectations entering the year, last week's labor market data reported by the Bureau of Labor Statistics might have been, you know, received in a very different way, just sort of as the last necessary step on the path to rate cuts. One could even imagine that these sorts of data would comport with some investors' definition of a soft landing. But because these cuts and more had already fully been priced into markets alongside optimistic earnings forecasts, markets really only had one way to go. And I would note that this price action has also been exacerbated by deleveraging tied to the strengthening yen, the key global funding currency, since the Bank of Japan raised rates last month. And I think that's an underappreciated aspect of this negative liquidity shock and some of the forced sales to buy yen to close out some of that borrowing. But now that we're here, now that we're on the precipice of rate cuts, I think it's important that we not catastrophize. The US economy continues to grow, led by a CapEx boom, very much concentrated in data centers, green industry, renewable energy, and infrastructure. And it's one, as we've spoken about in prior months, of a magnitude that really hasn't been observed in 20 years, not since the telecom boom of the late 1990s. We know that base rates now will finish 2024 at least 50 basis points below where they sit today. And the sharp decline in longer-term interest rates of the past few weeks should foment some recovery in interest-sensitive sectors like housing, durable goods, as mortgage rates, as auto loans come down. And we also have saw record refinancings across the corporate sector in the first half of the year, which has reduced effective interest rates, widened financial buffers at many companies. And I would say that thanks to the Fed's patience, they also, of course, have massive amounts of firepower to respond more aggressively if the data disappoint further from here. So, to conclude, I would just say that depending on one's investment horizon, it may not be that risk has increased so much as the market's collective sensitivity to it. And, if you look historically, that tends to portend very attractive capital deployment opportunities going forward, maybe not today, but certainly the very near future, as investors get compensated to bear the downside surprises, the risk of downside surprises that frothier markets tend to ignore. So with that, Shane, thanks again for joining. I just want to, start with a question just in general about the market that you serve, the investors that you look after. Of course, historically, private markets, alternatives more generally, have been an asset class for institutions, institutional investors. But we're going through this period now that's been described as the democratization of alternatives, allowing everyday investors to have access to alternatives and again, private markets specifically. And in your view, what has fueled this democratization?
I think there's several factors, right, Jason, that ultimately have led us down this path today vis-a-vis private markets and the opportunity for wealth investors to really experience what the institutional market, institutional investors have had access to for a very, very long time, as you and I know. So I would say the primary things that one needs to consider as drivers for this have been the search for higher returns. Private markets often offer the potential, at least, for higher returns compared to the public markets. So that's an area that I think, and I think investors are attracted to opportunities in places like venture capital, private equity, real estate, private credit. I think diversification, adding private investments to a portfolio can certainly offer diversification benefits. And I think the financial advisor community gets that and understands that in terms of putting that in a client's portfolio. I think as well, access to growth companies, many high growth companies stay private for longer these days, delaying their public offerings, that is. So if you're a wealth investor and you're seeking to capture this growth, you have to invest in private companies at an earlier stage in their life cycle. I do think educational resources is a big, big topic in this area, and it is driving a lot of kind of ultimately the knowledge base and the comfort with which these wealth investors now have, because I think there's a lot more availability to educational resources and information about these private markets. Ultimately, as well, I think the institutional influence, I think as an industry, we like to compartmentalize things. And we will say there's institutional investors and there's these wealth investors, and they're two separate and distinct things. The reality, of course, is that there are individuals that sit on the boards of institutions, whether they be public funds, endowments, foundations, insurance companies, all of these folks have been investing for many, many years. And right beside that, as individuals, they've always wanted to have access to this. So I think that there is a kind of a driver as well. When we talk about the democratization, I do think it's actually the evolution of this business. It makes perfect sense. Why should institutional investors be the only one actually getting access to these private markets? It really should be going to the appropriate wealth investors as well. And to your point around your comments earlier around the time horizon of an investor, that should probably determine who's most suitable for a particular investment, as opposed to whether they're a public fund or whether they're a high net worth client.
It's interesting you mentioned the notion that companies are staying private for longer. Of course, this is something we spend a lot of time looking at. And really, this is the story of the industry itself. If you were to go back to the late 90s, the private markets were just a barbell. You had early stage venture, and then you had late stage private equity. At that time, was really mostly delistings. The old LBOs, take a company private, fix it up, maybe refloat it. And over that 25 years, that barbell is essentially filled in, where companies now can stay private for really as long as they want. Certainly any business up to $10, $15, $20 billion of enterprise value. And for me, I guess what has been interesting is when you see the number of public companies decline by about 50%, of course, all of that decline is what was traditionally the growth stocks or those earlier businesses. So to me, it's very natural that as the investment opportunity set changes for all of us, just that the public markets shrinking at least a number of companies, private markets growing, that all investors have to recalibrate in response to that change investment opportunity set. But that brings me to the second question. How do the specific investments utilized by individual investors differ from those institutions have availed themselves of for some time?
And I think this is where the innovation has really come in over the last 5 or so years in the industry. I would say that, you know, historically, if you look at what was on offer, it was very much these closed-end institutional funds with a drawdown structure. That was the typical product that would come and go from the wealth platform. In addition to raising money on the institutional side, one would take it to one or two banking platforms and you'd raise some money there. Paperwork's really, really cumbersome, operationally really ugly, somewhat confusing for a financial advisor, let alone the end client. So I would say at best, it was a clunky effort. You move forward, and what we have done today, I think as an industry, has been, we've been very thoughtful about putting the private market capabilities in more suitable investment structures. So whether it be non-traded REITs, interval funds, BDCs, all of these things that allow more accessibility and an easier understanding for individual investors. You know, the primary driver here is something that has little to no paperwork, has a ticker symbol in order to, you know, kind of invest in the vehicle, and also has a one-time capital call, an upfront capital call. All of those things from an investment structuring perspective have made it a lot easier. There's also the liquidity component to this. And I would say on the liquidity side, as you know, historically, the vast majority of institutional investments were highly illiquid. You were looking at long lockup periods, 5 to 10 years, which was very, very suitable and is suitable for that cohort. You look at individual investors, and quite frankly, you know, it may or may not be for the mass affluent, that mightn't be the best place to go. So now with these new structures in place, the typical vehicle for a private markets fund today in the high net worth space has monthly subscriptions and quarterly redemptions up to 5%. So I think there's this semi-liquid, or as I call it, semi-illiquid offering for the mass affluent. And I think it's a much better vehicle for a individual investor. I would also finally add, the most important thing at the end of the day is here at Carlyle, for example, all of our investors, whether they be institutional or individuals, they're all gaining access to the same deals. So we are not cherry picking deals for one versus the other ultimately. And so you're getting all the benefits that an institutional investor is getting, but you're getting it in a more appropriate construct for you, the individual investor.
So you mentioned the exposure to the entirety of the platform, not cherry picked, as you said. What is our strategy in this space? How are we responding to this interest from individual investors, again, as this investment opportunity has shifted over time?
I think if we look at the numbers, we're still in the early innings here. We're probably in the first or second inning. It's always good to have an Irish guy give a baseball analogy on one of these podcasts, but my kids tell me it's appropriate.
So, I thought the accent was New Jersey. Point that out to me.
So, by way of New Jersey these days. So I would say, look, I think the first thing you have to do is you have to get out into the market. And I think what Carlyle does an excellent job of, from senior leadership on down, is making ourselves available and being in front of end investors, end LPs, whatever construct they take. And we have spent an awful lot of time over the past year being out in the market globally, listening to what the demands are of these individual investors. And you take that inside and you look at what are your core investment capabilities today at the firm, whether they be in private equity, private credit, or in the solutions business. And I would say that you have to be vehicle agnostic, is how I describe it ultimately. So what we're trying to achieve is we're looking to bring our best-in-class investment strategies to our wealth channel in the most appropriate construct for that given geography in that part of the world, in that channel. So a complicated way of saying that it is complicated. However, when you unbundle it and we actually listen to the end clients, to these end LPs, you can really quickly get to a place where there's three or four core capabilities that Carlyle has that I think are unique and differentiate us in the market.
So we're in the early innings, but where do you see retail investors and their role in private markets in 5 to 10 years? What does the landscape look like? What sort of share of the market would you say is contributed in terms of capital in the retail space? Where do you see things going from here?
So this is an area of focus, obviously, for us and for all our peers. And why is that the case? So if we say today that the US market, give or take, on the wealth side is about 70% of all flows into private markets, I would say that the average client in what is a relatively mature market relative to the other geographies around the world has about a 4% allocation to alts. Now, when you sit down with our distribution partners, they're trying to get that 4% up to 8 to 10%. So in the US alone, that's a massive opportunity vis-a-vis the banking channel. You put that alongside Europe, the Middle East, Southeast Asia, Australia, and Canada, and Japan, and those are markets that are probably south of that today in terms of where they are, in terms of clients' allocation. So they're probably in the 0.5 to 2% range, trying to get up to 4 to 6. So you're going to see exponential flows over the next 3 to 5 years through the traditional banking channel. I think as well as an industry, we're starting to look at what this could look like in the insurance space, in the annuity space, particularly there. And ultimately the holy grail, while not there today, in my opinion, we all continue to look at the defined contribution, the DC market, as an area that ultimately I think we think getting back kind of full circle to the very beginning of this conversation about where are these actually, if you look about a client's investment horizon, if you think about the 401k space and someone that isn't looking to get out for, you know, 25, 30 years, today that is an area that is not open at all to private market investing as an individual. And that's something that I'd love to see change, but I don't think that happens in the short to medium term.
Great. Well, Shane, thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, it was a pleasure, and I look forward to coming back on this podcast at a future date.
Well, you're always welcome back. Very much enjoyed hearing your insights on the way individual investors are availing themselves of private markets. On behalf of the team here at Carlyle, thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us again for our next episode of Insights and Indicators.